Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Sabina Alkier. She's the Secretary of the Human Development and Capability Association, co-founded by Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum. Dr. Alkier is an economist and author of Valuing Freedoms, Sen's Capability Approach and Poverty Reduction. She works at the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard. Welcome, Dr. Alkier.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, this approach is very interesting to me because it has allowed the creation of a perspective that kind of mediates a lot of different political conflicts that that tend to roil our policy debates. So why don't we talk first about what is the perspective of the capabilities approach? Where did it come from, and how has Amartya Sen popularized and applied it?
The capability approach is an Aristotelian approach, so both Sen and Nussbaum have drawn on those roots. So it predates them, and other economists, including John Mill and Adam Smith, in various ways developed some of the insights. But Amartya Sen really has given it a basis and articulated the core concept. Capabilities are the real freedoms that people enjoy. They're people's ability to live valuable lives, have what he calls valuable beings and doings. And the importance of this approach is that within economics, it shifts the focus from economic growth as a mean, as an end in itself, to human beings, their freedoms, their fulfillment, as the ends by which any economic arrangements should be judged. So the approach is fundamentally a normative or moral approach that says that when we judge an economy or when we judge a health system or when we judge a social or political structure, what we should be judging it by is the freedoms that people enjoy as citizens and participants in it.
So when you look at, for instance, debates about equality versus liberty in a society, about whether people should have more money in their pockets from their taxes, tax reduction versus the kinds of social provision that we see in some societies, how would this approach change our perspective?
Equity is a key concept for Sen. Equity doesn't mean absolute egalitarianism or equality, but it does mean ruling out some of the grievous inequities that exist in people's life expectancies or health or ability to get along. So in a sense, the capability approach needs to be fleshed out and the distributional consequences need to be considered more. But basically what it says is that, again, rather than arguing about having equity versus having freedom, including freedom of the markets or freedom of property rights or freedom of different kinds that people argue about, we should take a more holistic or integrated approach and look at all of these, again, social structures according to people's freedoms. What Sen does also is that he brings in, at this point, in response to your question, more of a human rights perspective to say that there would be certain capabilities that are basic that should be given priority. He never lists those or creates a canonical set of them, as Martha Nussbaum does. But he does say that there are some things which should be afforded to all participants in a society, no matter what. And when he then develops discussions of the market system, for example, one of the questions that he would ask is, to what extent can the market provide for these very basic subsistence, nutritional, and other capabilities for people, and what institutions, non-market institutions, need to be provided in addition to the market.
Well, what is Martha Nussbaum's contribution? What is the canonical set that she's introduced?
She has identified 10 central human capabilities that she argues should be given constitutional importance among all nations of the world. And she's specified these and advocated them as a basis for constitutional guarantees. And so they are akin to human rights in that they set thresholds beneath which, she argues, a person cannot live a human life. Many people, including myself, have welcomed her effort and welcomed very much her enterprise of trying to put a wider and more integrated set of human concerns on the political agenda. However, we feel her list is a bit too prescriptive and too normative, and that the identification of what capabilities are valuable should be done by the people concerned themselves. And in my own work, I've certainly used a list or a set of dimensions, but gone out to poor communities and had them articulate how they saw the dimensions to be valuable within their own lives.
So what would the relationship, for instance, between Martha Nussbaum's conception of constitutional guarantees of fundamental social rights and the guarantees in, for instance, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which has also a list of social rights?
Martha Nussbaum's list is a bit shorter in that she only has about 10 central human functional capabilities, but they're also much broader. So one of them, for example, is emotions, being able to have attachments to people outside ourselves, to love those who love us, to grieve, to experience longing and gratitude. These go beyond the human rights. Similarly, she talks about senses, imagination, and thought as being a central capability that people should develop, consideration for other species. But then she also includes things that would be human rights, like being able to have good health, reproductive health, to be nourished, to have adequate shelter. So I think that it would be fair to say her list is broader than the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Now, the debate about rights, there have been, of course, many debates over the last 400 years about the concept of rights, but one of the debates about rights is the debate about rights from and rights to, whether the rights concept should be taken not only to mean that people shouldn't infringe on your rights to exercise certain kinds of capabilities, but also whether there is a social obligation to empower people to exercise certain kinds of rights. Does this help us, does this capabilities approach help us think about that argument in a different way?
Yes. Sen draws on very much the Kantian idea of imperfect obligations. So there are perfect obligations that can be legally prescribed, and some human rights, but very few of them, are of that nature. But there's an imperfect obligation to do what you can to help others, and this would link into an idea of responsibility to respect others' human rights. Sen often gives the example of the woman who was tragically raped and murdered as 60 people looked on from their apartments in New York City, and clarifies that the person who committed the crime was certainly guilty of transgressing a perfect legal obligation not to do such horrendous things, but the 60 people who looked on were also fell short of their imperfect obligation to do what they could to help another person. And he places quite a bit of stress on this, this concept that we don't need to constrain our consideration for other human beings only to those rights that we are legally obliged to respect.
So this, from this argument, you could then derive a social obligation to coercively, in the views of libertarians, tax people and provide certain public goods.
I would take that position. I'm not sure that I would see taxes as coercive. But
just in the view of certain libertarians.
Yes, certainly.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm speaking with Sabina Alkair. She's the secretary of the Human Development and Capability Association, which is an international network of scholars pursuing the capabilities approach to social policy. Let's talk about healthcare policy a little bit. If we were to look at social priority setting around the provision of a basic healthcare package, which of course applies to most of the world, but not the United States yet, because we don't have a basic healthcare package in the United States. But in countries that do have a universal provision of healthcare, how would a capabilities approach allow us or illuminate our decisions about what kinds of healthcare services should be provided in that and shouldn't be?
I think there would be a number of different insights, and remember that the capability approach is quite rich, but also it because it is more of an overarching set of ideas, people have been filling it in very different ways. But one of the insights it could bring to bear is that we do indeed want greater health equity. So Sen often brings attention to the disparity between life expectancies, not only between people in developed countries and developing countries, but also within America, for example. I worked for 4 years near Anacostia in Washington, D.C., and there the life expectancy of an African-American male is 58 years, whereas the national life expectancy would be over 73. So there are great disparities in health, and Sen and a capability approach urges us to create a greater equity in certain of these basic healthcare functions. But on the other hand, you also would need to do that bearing in mind that there are differences. For example, unencumbered women will naturally live longer than men. And if we aimed at sort of a very tight definition of health equality, then we would, in a sense, give women less medical care than men in order that they achieve the same life expectancy. So it's not a rigorous approach that demands equality in things where there isn't much sense in doing so, but it would certainly require that as a set of goals. I think, in addition, consideration has to be given to what people consider health priorities in their lives. And so some public debate about what priority to give, I'm trying to think of an example, but different health,
Well, let me give you an example. I think one of the concerns that many people have about the provision of public goods is that that if we prioritize some kind of equity and some needs of the poor, that we're going to be taking away capabilities or opportunities for the middle class and the affluent, or at least the affluent have those concerns. And so would the capabilities approach, does it necessarily have built into it a logic that says that we should change, you know, shift resources from the wealthy to the poor, or does it does it say instead that everybody's opportunities in society should be leveled up?
The sort of categorical expression of this for Sen was we need to, and there's a difference between Sen and Nussbaum, is for Sen the objective is to expand capabilities. And so he makes a very clear assertion that this is relevant to rich people as well as to poor people. So someone with the capability to eat caviar might want to expand capabilities of a certain fine or literary or artistic nature. And you could still use this approach in thinking about how best to do that. Nussbaum argues that there is sort of a universal need to get everybody above a threshold of basic or central human capabilities. And then after that, she doesn't really have much of a project. So in a sense, she does not speak to the rich. But I think in their practical and more applied writing, Sen has often pointed out that there, and I think many other people in addition to these two are pointing out that we can get a great way towards reducing some of the very grievous deprivations in the world, not by taking away vast amounts from the rich, as you put it, but rather just from using the resources that are at hand more effectively or investing small amounts.
Don't get me wrong. I'm all for taking away the things from the rich and redistributing to the poor.
Yeah.
It's just that this is one of the great obstacles, you know, for instance, in the United States in setting up some kind of social provision. And I said I'd give you an actual example, and then I didn't. I just gave you a hypothetical. But how about an actual example, something like cosmetic surgery? We have this great debate in the, or for instance, in vitro fertilization. We have this debate about whether health insurance plans should be required to provide in vitro fertilization. And this clearly expands the capabilities of infertile couples to have children, but others argue that this that the costs of in vitro fertilization in general for society should be better spent on expanding the capabilities of real dire social needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would seem from what you're saying that Sen would say that it's okay to have for everybody's capabilities to be increased at that end as well as at the other end.
I think what is both frustrating but also very rich about the capability approach is that what it says about certain decisions is that they should be framed to make clear what the trade-offs are. So if the greater provision of in vitro fertilization for, say, 18 couples takes away the ability of 54 mothers to have prenatal and postnatal care, or a greater number indeed, then these are distributional considerations and political considerations, and in the end they are value judgments as to which of these aspects of healthcare are more important to people. And Sen, again and again, both in economic and health and education in different spheres, argues that these value judgments have to be made by public debate and discussion by an elected and democratic system, that they are not the kinds of things economists can make on technical grounds, nor indeed should politicians make them on grounds of voting or something, but the nature of these decisions is that they are value judgments that affect different people and different aspects of their lives. And so people may find it unsatisfactory, but I think it is actually empowering because the capability approach is trying to involve the public within any country, poor or rich, in the making of these decisions or in their scrutiny or in their criticism.
Now, you worked for the Catholic Commission on Human Security.
It wasn't Catholic, it was UN, yes.
Oh, it's a UN? Oh, I thought that we have something in the States that the Catholic Church runs, some commission, but you also have a degree in Christian ethics.
Yeah.
And so my question is that whether this approach, the capabilities approach, as a distinctive perspective on social policy has some special resonance with Christian ethics.
I believe that it does, in a sense that it seems to have been taken up by a large number of people who are people of faith. And the reason that it does, I believe, is that it, again, shifts from the means to the ends. It shifts attention to human flourishing or fulfillment. So if you think of the Catholic social teachings, the end of economic development in Populorum Progressio was the vocation to human flourishing. And I'm not a Catholic, but a lot of my research was using the natural law theory, which is an Aristotelian approach, and using the Catholic form of it because it has a very clear synergy. The concept of freedom which it has is very similar to Sen's concepts of freedom. So I think that there's a synergy there. And also Javier Iguinez in Peru, and I must say the our association is in 50 countries, so we have many colleagues in different places. He wrote a book on the synergy between Sen's work and liberation theology. So there is a very active subgroup of the association on religion and development, and each year there are papers from Christian perspective, but also from other religious perspectives, trying to explore, in particular, how to fill in the idea of fulfillment.
This is Dr. J. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking with Sabina Alkire. She's the Secretary of the Human Development and Capability Association, which was founded by Nobel Prize winner. He won a Nobel Prize in, for what? Economics.
Economics,
right? Yeah. Economics. Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen and the philosopher Martha Nussbaum. And Dr. Alkire is an economist and author of Valuing Freedoms, Sen's Capability Approach and Poverty Reduction. She works at Harvard. The association, what is its goal? And you said that it's active in 50 different countries, and so you have conferences, and what else are you doing?
Our goal is to really stimulate research that cuts across disciplines. So it's economics, it's philosophy, it's political science, and also looks at poverty issues, justice, gender, development, the environment. So it takes a more integrated or multidisciplinary perspective at some of the pressing social issues. And our aim is partly to do research, but also to do research that engages with the public sphere. Sen and Nussbaum are very noteworthy in that they are also both public intellectuals who will write for newspapers or for magazines, as well as in academic circles. And so this is also an association which is trying to build bridges between researchers and practitioners, and also to encourage communication with the media so that that becomes habitual. We have members in 50 countries. We have annual conferences. The next conference is in Paris, and it's on knowledge and public action. And we also have small meetings, one in India recently, others on how to communicate with the media, others on certain aspects. There's going to be one on happiness and subjective well-being in Italy. So it's at the moment, it's our first year of operation, so we're still learning what to do, but we're trying to focus on research and communication at the moment.
I'm sure you've looked at the subjective well-being literature. I recently published a book called Citizen Cyborg, and I quote some of that literature that the Dutch researcher, I'm spacing out his name, but he's got a wonderful website.
Van Hoven,
yeah. He's done some wonderful work that generally supports the notion that social democratic societies have higher subjective well-being. But then other people have come along in the last couple of years and have suggested that, in fact, there's very little that that any of our social conditions can do to influence people's individual happiness set points. That we have, that we have an innate happiness, and if we win the lottery or if we have terrible tragedies, we may be temporarily disturbed from that and then come back to that happiness. And that would seem to be a kind of a challenge for this notion of using, at least I know that, and this is, I think, the distinction between a capabilities approach and a happiness-oriented approach. actually a simple utilitarian approach, isn't it?
Yes.
That the utilitarian approach might be waylaid by that kind of evidence that nothing that you do in social matters might influence people's happiness, but the capabilities approach would say, well, look, we're expanding people's capabilities.
Yes, I think there are two ways to answer that. The first is that within economics, which is my subject, there was a big divide in 1932, and it had to do exactly with this. Lionel Robbins famously split economics from ethics and saying the two could not relate to each other except by juxtaposition. And what led him to do this was a wonderful example of a poor Brahmin that Sir Henry Maine in the UK had described. And Sir Henry Maine said, I am 10 times as capable of happiness as that untouchable person. And Robbins' reflection is that if a Brahmin felt him or herself to be 10 times more capable of happiness as an untouchable Indian, then how could this be verified by an independent observer? How could economists know the happiness of individual people and their, particularly their internal happiness scales? So that shifted economics from being based on sort of a cardinal utility approach to being based on revealed preference. And Sen has reacted against revealed preference but argued that we do not need to look at happiness, rather we only need to look at people's capabilities. And he often gives the example of a widow who might be very happy and serene, and yet her deprivation might be severe, but she's become accustomed to it and is grateful for small mercies. He also looked at the comparative health status of widows in Bihar, which is one of the poorest states in India, and in Kerala, which is one of the most wealthy. And the health objective indicators of Kerala women were much higher than the widows in Bihar. However, their self-reported health status, in Bihar the widows were fairly happy, whereas in Kerala they said this is absolutely terrible. And their self-reported health status was exactly the opposite of their objective health status, relatively. So Sen has led us really to question quite considerably the utilitarian basis of economic judgments, and instead to look at other objective indicators. At the same time, I think if you look beyond simple and a fleeting emotional happiness, which is much more a function of whether you're extroverted and all of these things, whether you're an optimist, but look at domain-specific life satisfaction, then we can get an interesting insight into certain aspects of life. I'm looking right now at a measure that Richard Ryan, a psychologist, has come up with about empowerment or people's agency or autonomy. And this seems to be a bit more accurate than very, very general questions about how happy a person is with their life.
Just, I want to get to those measures in a second, but one of the surveys last year that looked at an international survey of happiness found that Nigerians were the happiest people in the world. And if you derived your social policy recommendation utilitarianly on the basis of Nigerians being the happiest, I don't think we'd get very far. But let's talk about measures of that. I mean, one of the measures that I know from health policy research is the measure of the degree of disability that people have, which would be at a kind of low level, I think, maybe of the capabilities approach. Can people get out and shop? Can they walk? Can they, you know, clothe themselves and things like that? What other kinds of measures are being proposed for measuring people's capabilities, some kind of social policy measure?
The very first measure was the Human Development Index, which was put out in 1990 by a friend, the late Mahbub al-Haq, a friend of Amartya Sen's. And that index is a simple combination of literacy, life expectancy, and income per capita. And these are basically scaled and then added up and divided by 3 in a very, very crude manner. And Sen objected initially very strongly to the development of such an index because it leaves so much out, which he argues to be important, freedom most of all. But at the time, it was used for political purposes, and Mahbub al-Haq said, I would like something as crude as GNP per capita, but better. And GNP per capita is the current way that the wealth of nations is measured. So that was the very first one. And since then, there have been, I think, 2 different kinds of developments. One is that many different dimensions of well-being, in addition to health and education, have come to be measured, and in some cases to be aggregated or compared. So there's a whole industry of multidimensional poverty measures and poverty comparisons, which the World Bank is doing and some other economists are doing. The other I think, area of interest, which is the one I'm working in right now, is how do you bring freedom into this? Freedom both in the sense of people's agency, their ability to act on their own behalf and be have a hand in their own destiny, and also the opportunities that lie open to them. And so there are, as I mentioned, some measures of autonomy that have been developed in psychology, actually, and then some current research underway on trying to measure opportunity structures that people look into. All of these, of course, being among the population of the poor people.
Sabina, this has been fascinating. And what kinds of people, this will have to be the last question, what kinds of people are you trying to recruit for the Human Development and Capability Association? How can people participate? Where's the website and things like that?
Anybody's welcome. It's mostly, you know, younger people with a lot of energy and a vision to change the world and all of what that comes with it. So academics who also have a social commitment. The website is www.hd-ca.org, and you can join the association there. You can read our mission statement. You can see bibliographies. You can get information on conferences or events. So that's very much a clearinghouse, or as we call it, our tea house. So anybody would be welcome to visit that site, www.hd-ca.org.
I really want to thank you for joining us today, and I think it is such a fascinating perspective. I've been speaking with Sabina Alkire. She's the Secretary of the Human Development and Capability Association, founded by Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum. She's an economist and author of Valuing Freedom, Sen's Capability Approach and Poverty Reduction. She works at Harvard with the Global Equity Initiative. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I just want to add a brief reflection on the capabilities approach as it applies to human enhancement medicine, which is from a paper called Somatic and Germline Gene Therapy, a Debate on the Ethics of Genetic Enhancement by Ilana Jacobs. She says, when applied to gene therapy and enhancement, the capability theory takes a unique stance on what ought to be. If society has a moral obligation to ensure that each person has equal inherent capabilities, then it follows that we are obligated to perform germline gene therapy to ensure inherent equality for future generations. In order to promote true freedom and equality, this theory states we must make everyone genetically equal in genetic endowment so that merit can be judged solely by hard work and motivation. Again, that's in the paper Somatic and Germline Gene Therapy, a Debate on the Ethics of Genetic Enhancement by Ilana Jacobs. You can find that paper online. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.